From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Rodney Asher's documentary film explores how we all experience art, how some of us see one thing and others of us see, well, other things. He's particularly interested in why we find deeper meanings in film and how that can alter our perception of the world. If that all seems a little highfalutin, consider how he goes about it. His documentary focuses on Stanley Kubrick's 1980 horror film, The Shining. He profiles the film's most ardent followers. These are people who are sure they've discovered messages they say Kubrick hid in the film. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation we had last year with Asher about his documentary. It's called Room 237, and what it's really about is what it means to be a fan. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling another film in our Through the Lens series. It's another one of those strange and engrossing films. This one is called Room 237. It's about Stanley Kubrick's 1980 horror film, The Shining. Now, some critics hated the film, thought it was cheesy, not up to his usual standards. But there are others who see a masterpiece in the film. They see hidden symbols and patterns, really weird stuff like Greek myths and a faked moon landing. We spoke with the filmmakers Rodney Asher and Tim Kirk at the 2012 Sundance Film Festival. That's where their film premiered. We're showing Room 237 next Wednesday night. We should say Rodney Asher is going to be on hand afterwards to answer questions, and I'm guessing you're going to have a lot of them. Rodney Asher directed Room 237. His short film, The S from Hell, premiered at the festival in 2010. Tim Kirk is a producer and a screenwriter. He produced Room 237 and his film Bewitched. With a question mark, I guess, in there. It was featured in the 2006 Los Angeles Film Festival. And, gentlemen, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having us.
Thank you.
Rodney Asher, let me begin with you. So when did you first see The Shining?
Oh, I saw it on its initial release. I must have been, 11 or 12 years old, though, to tell the truth, I only made it through about the first 15 minutes. And I think it was not just the effect, of the incredibly horrifying music that opens the film, but having been teased by the credits to know how horribly everything was going to go, and while watching sort of those really elegant Steadicam shots tracking Jack into the lobby and into the meeting, there was this sort of sense of inevitability, the way that everything seems nice now, but at a certain point, this guy is going to be chasing his family with an axe. And although as a kid, I had snuck into Friday the 13th and Halloween and Alien by that point, and I just saw them as kind of exciting action movies, but The Shining was more than I could take.
You've talked about it being a sensory overload. Why? What was it? Because it was so packed with something, you weren't quite sure, but there was something there that was different.
Well, certainly, I think that says a lot to its staying power.
Yeah.
Again, I think it was most – I think for me, for 11-year-old me in 1980, it was about that music and that just overpowering sense of doom and menace and an unavoidable tragedy that overloaded my circuits.
Tim, what about you? When did you first see it? Do you remember? Did you have any
– Yeah, I saw it the opening weekend at Grauman's Chinese and had an older friend – drive us into town and buy the tickets. And similarly, I had seen by that point Strangelove and Clockwork Orange, so I was assuming he was just going to blow my mind. And so I was very much on the edge of my seat the whole time. And I remember when the film ended, if you see a film at the Grauman's during the day, when they throw the doors open, light hits the screen, and I could see the shadows of people leaving. And I thought it was still part of the film, and I was staring intently, wondering what this had to do with the rest of it, and still trying to figure it out.
Well, it's funny because that ties into something that Bill Blakemore wrote in his original article. Bill Blakemore is kind of the guy who lit the match that started the fire of intense Shining analysis. He's one of our major interviewees, and he talks about the Native American themes, and he's this heavy, serious, globe-trotting ABC journalist. And one of the things that he wrote in his original article, which unfortunately we didn't have time to get into in our film, is that over the music, over the during the music and the sound during the closing credits, very soft in the audio, you hear an audience sort of clapping and getting up to go, and that there's something, and that when the real audience is watching the movie, and they maybe a couple people clap and then they murmur and they get up to go, they won't hear that noise and know that it's part of the movie. They'll just assume that that's the environment around him. But he sees that, if I remember correctly, as a way of talking about how this movie is about you in the audience now. And he's trying to blur the line between the audience and the film.
So at what point did you start thinking about creating a movie about this? I mean, how did it – where did it start and how did it evolve, which we'll get to, but where did it start?
Well, I mean, after this movie's done very much in the style – you know, it's a bigger, more ambitious film, but done very much in the style of a short I did a couple years ago, The S from Hell. And I wanted to take that style further and do something bigger and more ambitious. And Tim emailed me an article by Jay Widener that talked about the whole moon landing theory. And, you know, at first I didn't think too much of it, but as I read the article and there was point after point after point and element of the film after element of the film after element of the film that added up to it, it started to get really eerie.
Yeah.
And I said to myself that, well, that could be an interesting short if we just did that, but what else is out there? And I had remembered in college reading a Stanley Kubrick book in which the numerology of the film was analyzed very closely. You know, that if you add up 2, 3, 7, it's 12, or if you multiply it, it's 42, and the number 7 has significance, and 12 reversed is 21, which is 2001 A Space Odyssey, which many people see as the mirror image for The Shining, that if 2001 is an evolution, then The Shining is a de-evolution. And that stuck with me, and I actually made a little joke thing about that years ago. And I had a vague memory of Bill Blakemore's article about the Native Americans, which I think he wrote in 87. And I said, well, if we find three of these, maybe we can have three 10-minute segments, and that'd be like a cool half-hour thing of these radically different looks at the movie. And then we started looking around, and we were kind of overwhelmed by how much is really out there and how this film, more than others, inspires this type of close reading and intricate analysis and – you know, it's almost a level of biblical scholarship. And, you know, some folks, I would say maybe John Phil Ryan, almost looks at it like a Kabbalah scholar.
Yeah, we laugh about that moment when we thought, God, if we could just find a few more of these, because...
Yeah, like that would be hard.
Yeah, because there's so much out there, and there's been so much written about it. And fairly quickly in our research, we were realizing we were going to have to jettison the idea of a comprehensive overview of every theory about The Shining, which just was not going to fit in anything other than a 9-part miniseries.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you, it's interesting, the style of the film, almost, I guess maybe all of, or certainly almost all of the imagery comes from movies.
The lion's share of it, yes.
Yeah, most of it. And we don't see the people you've interviewed, which leads me to wonder, is this about them and the way they're processing it, or the theories themselves?
I like to think it's more about the ideas.
Yeah.
That incidentally, as people are talking, some of their biographical stuff leaks into the narrative, and usually in ways that inform what they're saying in a really interesting way. But something I think about just the voices makes it maybe a little more universal. And it isn't Bill Blakemore, it's a journalist. And it isn't Jeffrey Cox, it's a professor. And these are sort of maybe five people who represent a type of people.
Well, after a while, it almost doesn't matter in some ways, right?
Yeah. And I also just always kind of hated talking headshots.
Yeah.
That, you know, in a movie that's got a lot of big fantastical ideas, to cut back to a guy sitting in his office or in his house is a mundane level of reality. And we want it to be way up into the head, way up into our heads.
And it's so visual, the film. I mean, it's almost... it's really difficult to talk about in some ways on the radio because a lot of the imagery and a lot of the ideas are based on what you see. You show us the example of what some of these people are talking about in the film itself. But that's an important part of the film. It's incredibly, I guess that's obvious, but very visual.
Well, what was interesting is there were times when I was talking to these people and I was doing these audio interviews, I mailed everybody. This was a super low-budget project. I I mailed people digital audio recorders, and then I called them up on the phone.
Wow.
And I said, all right, so we press the red button. Now press it again. Is the light blinking, or is it solid? Is the counter moving? All right, let's go. But sometimes they'd be describing a scene in the movie, and although I like to think I'm in the upper 50 percentile of people who are familiar with The Shining,
yeah,
they were often describing things that I just didn't know what the hell they were talking about.
Yeah.
But then when I would play it back to the movie, I'd be, oh, my God, they're exactly right to this microscopic detail.
Yeah.
So sometimes there are things, like during their interviews, that didn't strike me as especially interesting or provocative or important until I put it to the film. I was like, that elevator is impossible. Like when we come around the corner, I see it. So well, the wall space is only like 4 feet deep.
Yeah, yeah. People are gonna love going back to The Shining, I think, after seeing this documentary. Let's talk about Bill Blakemore first. Early in the film, I want to play an excerpt from the movie and the documentary. Early in the film, Bill Blakemore is talking about his first experience with The Shining. And maybe, Rodney, if you could say something about the Calumet baking soda can, because he does reference that in this. Of course, Bill Blakemore has this idea that what Stanley Kubrick was about was the genocide of the American Indian.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's this – do you want to say something about that Calumet?
Well, I think the can was maybe something that stuck out to him,
yeah,
that made him look at the movie through that lens. He grew up near the Calumet River or lake in Chicago. And the word means peace pipe, which is something that I had no idea of. And there's like an Indian head, like a stylized, almost cartoonish Indian head on the can. So I think he saw that word and it made him start to think about Native Americans. And then as the movie progressed, he started to see more and more to support that idea. So he really looks at the can as the key, as an indicator of, try looking at it this way.
I went in to see this movie in Leicester Square, a movie theater right near Leicester Square in London, and I remember it quite clearly from, I can even remember the seats we were sitting in. If I went back to the theater, I could point them to you, sort of near the back and over to the left. From the moment of the opening astonishing helicopter shot, I was terrified. I had no idea what was coming. I remember sort of sitting on the front edge of my theater seat there to keep from falling off. And I remember gripping my belt buckle with my left hand, I think it was. Yes, my left hand. Sort of to keep from falling off the edge of the seat. And to try to control my terror as I watched this movie. I had no idea what was coming. I hadn't read the book. I'd barely seen any of the posters. And I remember that I was stunned when the movie was over. We left the theater, went in down into our underground car park to get into the car to leave. And as we were driving up out of the car park, I was sitting in the back left seat. I was thinking, what was that? What was that? What was it? What was it? What was it? And I think my visual imagination looked at that Calumet baking powder can, the one right behind Halloran's head when he's talking to Danny. I knew what Calumet meant. It meant peace pipe. And I thought to myself, peace pipe, Indians. Oh, my goodness, they're all over the place in that movie.
So Blakemore sees a Kubrick film as a puzzle, that he's putting these hidden messages. Did you hear a lot of that, that Kubrick is sending a message?
Certainly. I think everybody who talks about the film says this is more than a horror movie.
Yeah.
This is more than a story of a family trapped in a hotel. I mean, some of them might explicitly look at it as a puzzle, but others might just say this character is reminiscent of this type of historical figure. This visual recalls this painting. That will sort of inform it and add extra layers as you're watching it.
Jay Widener says something that's always resonated with me, which was that the film is three-dimensional chess.
Hmm.
And so that it's working on a lot of different levels. It's working on a level as a story about a family disintegrating, about a man trying to kill his family. It works on a couple of other levels. And a lot of people sort of share that view.
And certainly that's probably inspired by 2001, which was clearly intended as a thought-provoking, open-ended, you know, sort of philosophical parable, I guess. Mm-hmm.
What Wiedner says that 2001 was kind of a religious experience for him.
Yes.
Explicitly so,
yeah. Yeah. And let me play another moment, because I think this is another important part of your film, is that it's not just a movie for these people. I mean, these images kind of change their lives. The symbols that they see and the perception that they get from that changes their lives. This is Jay Wiedner from the film Room 237.
And I had never in my life envisioned that a movie could do what this movie was doing. And it was showing me things that I'd never seen. And it was intellectually challenging. And it was an artistic masterpiece in every way, from the soundtrack to the visuals to the storyline. And when the movie ended, I couldn't get out of my seat. I was frozen in the seat, completely paralyzed by what I just witnessed, and the usher actually had to come and get me out. And I was the last person, me and her, and I staggered out of the theater completely changed as a human being, and decided at that moment that the only thing I wanted to do for the rest of my life was to make films in one fashion or another. And so I have done that. So I owe Stanley Kubrick and his film 2001 Space Odyssey everything for everything that I have become in my life. So,
which is great, you know, mm-hmm. that a piece of art can sort of transform your life. And I think in that sense, you get that throughout your film.
And what really excited me about the way he describes it is there's such a parallel to 2001.
Yeah.
Where, you know, there's no greater transformation in the movies than, you know, David Bowman turning into an old man and then the star child. And Jay has a similar transformation. He is a different person when he walks out of this, when he walks out of the theater.
Let me ask you about Jeffrey Cox. First saw The Shining in 1980, he says, in your film, when it came out.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't think much of it. But then it got him thinking, and things started. I guess it's in some ways like you, Rodney Asher. In some ways, it's didn't know what to make of it. And then he began to see this kind of subtext. And for him, it was the Holocaust. So you have... what's his name? The fellow Bill Blakemore, who sees genocide of the American Indian. Jeffrey Cox sees the Holocaust. He sees Nazi Germany. What do you make of that? In some ways they're similar. In some ways they're completely different. And it's just so interesting the way different people see different things in a piece of art like that.
Well, I think that's one of. I'm really glad that you see it that way, because I think that was one of the ideas that we found most compelling as we were trying to put it together. I don't know that I can entirely reconcile the two thoughts, because it's almost as if I believe the last person that I hear, and then we talk to somebody else, and I start to drift into their camp. And Kubrick was notoriously the kind of guy who wouldn't want to explain exactly what he was getting at.
Yeah.
Though from what these people know about his biography, it is reasonable to suggest that those concerns were something that was, you know, really important to him and something that he thought a lot about.
Yeah.
Bill Blakemore talks about something that's really resonated with me and I think touches on this, is he talks about Kubrick's process as being boiling down, that he would research and that he would think about his life experiences and the experiences of you know, life on Earth until this moment, and boil it down into these very sparse, significant images. And if you look at The Shining, it's a very sparse film in a lot of ways, and yet people see so much in it.
Well, maybe one thing that's interesting trying to compare Bill and Jeff is, I mean, as you describe it, Bill says Native Americans, Jeff says Nazis and the Holocaust, and that might sound like two very different things, but those guys both came out for our premiere and have been corresponding a little bit since the film has been completed.
Huh.
And they're very simpatico.
Yeah.
And they're very excited about exchanging ideas and comparing notes. And they're not what they're not doing is arguing. You're right, I'm right. You're right, I'm wrong. I think that's backwards. But
you're wrong, I'm right.
You're wrong,
yeah.
I'm right. Yeah.
Yeah. I did wonder about that. How the others were what the others were making of these symbols that other people were seeing, and if they were but they're not fundamentalist about it. They can see it as well.
Well, I can't speak to what all of the five think about all the others.
Yeah.
I can say that Jeff and Bill get along really well and are very excited to compare notes.
Yeah, I had dinner with them and their wives, and we would talk about this and that in Sundance and how beautiful the weather was and how everything, and then all of a sudden these two would disappear into Kubrick for, you know, just go down the rabbit hole, and me and the women would be looking at each other, ordering wine and so forth.
I think those two are, to be fair, a little skeptical of Jay's theories, but he is coming from a very different place and a very different discipline.
Yes.
Rodney Asher, he directed the film Room 237. Tim Kirk is the producer. It premiered at the 2012 Sundance Film Festival. That's where we spoke with them. Next Wednesday night at 7 o'clock, we're screening Room 237 at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Rodney Asher will be on hand after the screening for a Q&A, and trust us, you're going to have questions. We have more details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're rebroadcasting a conversation we had at the 2012 Sundance Film Festival about the documentary film Room 237. It's about Stanley Kubrick's 1980 horror film The Shining and about how different people react to it, how they see different meanings and symbols. We're showing Room 237 next Wednesday night at 7 at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center. It's part of our Through the Lens series in partnership with the Utah Film Center. You can learn more about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. So I guess the most outlandish, I guess it's fair to say, interpretation of The Shining comes from Jay Widener. He sees in the film what he believes to be Stanley Kubrick's involvement in faking the moon landing in the 60s. And Widener wonders if Kubrick left these clues in the film about his own involvement, Kubrick had helped film this, and he had this sense of guilt about it, I guess, the fact that he had lied to people, that he had participated in this conspiracy. Let me play a clip. This is Jay Widener talking about what he sees in The Shining, and how he wasn't sure if he was right at first. And then there's this moment in the film, people may remember Danny, the little boy who stands up, and he has this sweater, and it has Apollo 11, a rocket, on it. And that was, I guess, the clincher for Jay Widener. Here's another clip from the film Room 237.
And I wasn't sure I was right for the first hour. I wasn't sure that I had actually, you know, I wasn't sure if I was blurring the line between what I wanted to see and what I was seeing. And then at about 58 minutes in the film is the famous scene where Danny's playing with his trucks and he stands up and he's wearing the Apollo 11 sweater with a rocket taking off. Then I knew I had nabbed it. And then I started watching the film with an intensity that I don't think I've ever watched a movie before. And every line began ringing true. You know, Wendy, that is just so typical of you. Don't you know I have obligations to my employers? Do you have any idea what a contract is? Do you know what an agreement is? Jack Nicholson's whole tirade against his wife, that's Stanley. That's Stanley telling his wife that, you know, after she discovered what he was doing, which was the Apollo footage.
So what do you guys make of that? And you don't need to comment on whether or not you think it's crazy, but just a lot of people think it's pretty outlandish. And I wanted to know how you approach that as filmmakers, because it seems like if you weren't careful, it could come across that, frankly, all of these people, in some way or another, seem to be stretching some of the symbols, or they see things that some people might say, now, come on. But how did you draw that balance between being respectful of what they had to say and making fun of them? Do you know what I mean? Because you don't make fun of them
in
the film.
Well, it was important that I wasn't. And, I mean, I don't think that they're silly, so I didn't really have a motivation to make fun of them. Yeah. And if making fun of them was the point of the movie, I think 20 minutes on, people would say, I get it, and lose interest for the rest of it. What I love is their passionate engagement, investigation in the movie that people don't feel this way, and they don't see these kind of things in a lot of movies. Most movies aren't worth spending this much time in, getting this personally invested in. I can say absolutely, as I talk to these people, that I can watch The Shining and see it very vividly through their eyes.
Yeah.
They describe it in so much detail, and there's always a point when you get 3, 4, 5 details in the film that reinforce your idea, when it starts to become very, very persuasive. And Jay's thing in our film, you know, is maybe a short 7-minute section about the moon landing. He has his own 1-hour-long documentary on that subject, and he has 2 more films in the can ready to go on the Kubrick subject. So although we tell a little bit of his theory, if you spend an hour going through all of the stuff he has, it becomes incredibly, incredibly fascinating.
Yeah.
And a lot of people find it very, very persuasive. Certainly, if somebody was going to fake the moon landing, Kubrick's an amazing choice because he had just finished a movie with a very realistic moon landing sequence. He had consulted NASA about it. He's a guy who was publicity shy, knew how to keep his mouth shut. A couple years later, come Barry Lyndon, it was very convenient that NASA loaned him these special lenses that could film in incredibly low light, lenses designed for filming in outer space so that he could shoot by candlelight. And there are many more details, if you go deeper into his work, that tie it in. So it becomes a really fascinating story. And, I mean, you can hear his delivery. He's an amazing storyteller. He's very he puts so much of himself into it. I'm just totally there with him from beginning to end.
We talked about this so much back and forth about the tone and it came down to we respect these people are so passionate and so intelligent and have put so much into this film. Jay actually was a little reluctant to be involved in the film at one point, and he said flat out to us, "Look, here's my concern is you're going to have me on. I'll say my say, and then you'll have another guy that comes on and says he's crazy."
Yeah.
And we're like, we're not going to do that. And we knew we weren't going to do that.
Yeah, I mean,
you know, I should say, he does not think that we did not go to the moon.
And that's important. That's a very important point to him.
Yeah, he says it several times in the film. I believe that this happened, but which leads to another element that Jay Widener talks about that I wanted to ask you about. He talks about how. In essence, after Barry Lyndon, Kubrick was bored. He wasn't crazy about that film, and he was looking for something new. He was looking to do something big and different.
And The Shining is so different from Barry Lyndon.
Yeah, exactly. let me play this another moment. This is Jay Widener again from Room 237.
And so I think Stanley retreated after Barry Lyndon, and he began working on a new kind of film, a film that had never been made before, a film that was made by a bored genius who had thoroughly emptied the jug of everything that could be done in filmmaking, and he was looking for the next thing. And what he did was he began reading Subliminal Seduction and a number of other books, which were about how advertisers were injecting images, subliminal images, into advertising to sell products more.
It's such a fascinating part of the film, I have to say, because then you do see these. Look, whether you buy it or not, there's a lot of stuff in there that you don't notice right away.
Yeah, and Stanley Kubrick was so incredibly well-read. And one thing, when people describe The Shining, and if I was going to ask people, like, what's this movie about, it would probably be way down the list before people say ESP.
Yeah.
But The Shining is really an ESP novel. In the late 70s, ESP was on everybody's minds. And if you were going to go on a bookshelf in the late 70s looking at ESP books, one of the books you would see there would be Subliminal Seduction, which Jay thinks was a big inspiration for how he made this movie. And it's kind of a nice parallel because other people talk about books that they know Kubrick read that inspired different themes in the movie. And he sees this book, which – you know, I'd love when people do more work in Kubrick archives to find out what was in his library. But I bet he did read that book and that he did find it fascinating.
But you know what's interesting, though? I have to say, and I'm sure you're going to get this kind of reaction, this sort of skeptical reaction to say, like, there's a moment when Widener says, look, there's this paper tray in this particular scene, which sort of, as the scene is choreographed, it appears to be a phallus.
Mm-hmm.
There's this moment where this cloud somehow becomes Stanley Kubrick.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't see that. And I wonder if there isn't that part where you say you don't think these theories are silly, but are there moments when you think we are overthinking it a little bit? Maybe people are seeing too much in it. Do you know what I mean?
Well, I'm glad you signaled that out because – everyone looks at clouds and sees something different.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And so that appears in a really interesting moment in the film where I think it sort of is establishing a little bit of what we're saying, you know.
Yeah.
And yet, at the end of the film, we talk about how in quantum physics, where the process of looking affects the object.
Yeah.
And that's really mind-blowing.
Well, which is something that I discovered. This didn't make it into our film, but towards the tail end of the project, I was still reading up new ideas about The Shining. And there was a guy who's actually a friend of Jay's who made a little YouTube video where he calls out a little off-screen voice that he hears early in the film, the word Shon.
Shon.
Like shine in the past tense. And he says that happens a couple times during the film, and it's sort of a subliminal clue that something important is going to happen. And he discovered this maybe in February of 2011. And I've read a lot of Shining trivia, and I've never come across this. And I went back to listen to the movie, and I could kind of hear it. Cut to I'm looking at Julie Kearns' website. You know, she has her blog about The Shining, and she finds all kinds of amazing things in it.
This is another character in the film, we should say.
Yeah, and maybe 4 months after this one guy finds it, she finds it. And she didn't find it from looking at that guy's website. She found it from looking at The Shining, which gave me this kind of eerie, seasick feeling, like guy number one is watching this movie so closely that somehow he's able to make this anomaly manifest itself. And now other people can see it too.
Yeah.
That is so – it's so wild. I mean, does it make you love the movie even more?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Although now watching the movie is such a bizarre experience because I'm simultaneously watching it through like 7 different sets of eyeballs.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what I like about the film, too, is it's really self-referential at times. And there were these funny moments. Jay Fell Ryan, for example, I think that's who it is. His kid starts screaming in the background. And that we hear that, though. And the film sort of pauses for him to take care of it, which is kind of nice. And it's kind of a nice tone,
thanks.
I think. And there's a kind of an irreverence in some ways. It's really different.
Well,
that's the other thing. It's really different.
Well, thanks. I mean, that moment, first of all, it was a technical thing. There's no way that I could digitally erase the sound of the kid. But then there's also some interesting things happening because it's foreshadowing his relationship with his son,
yep.
which becomes very important at the end.
Yep.
It humanizes, you know, a guy who's kind of metaphysical at times. And then also, I mean, there's the fact I'm not Stanley Kubrick and I'm not a perfectionist and my movie was made in a much more modest way than his, so I'm kind of not afraid to let some of the cracks show.
And it adds another level, which is Tim and Rodney, who are both recent fathers,
yeah.
and we were often talking about this stuff at the park where all our kids were playing or taking walks with them. And watching the film again after many years for the first time as a father, was a very different experience.
Really?
I was all about Danny and his terror. It was almost unwatchable for me. Whereas before, I think I'd, in many ways, I'm ashamed to say it, I sort of rooted for Jack to go crazy because that's when it gets really cool and scary and interesting. And boy, it was a different experience.
Yeah. Well, and for me, watching it, especially while I was making it, was really a strange experience because I couldn't help but relate to Jack in that we were both guys working on our art project that nobody was especially interested in. And
neglecting your family, maybe a little bit.
Living in kind of a big open house with my wife and my son. And what working on this film looks like to an outsider is typing.
Yeah.
You know, and is this film gibberish? Is this film something people want to see, or is it all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy, just this, you know, incomprehensible navel gazing?
Yeah.
So I would try to be a little nicer when my wife would come by asking how things were going, or if maybe it wasn't time to take a break and take care of the boy for a little bit.
And were we each other's overlook that we're enabling this insane project to keep going forward? Yeah, that was a weird self-referential moment.
Tim Kirk, he produced the documentary film Room 237. Rodney Asher directed it. We're showing the film next Wednesday night as part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. Rodney Asher will be on hand after the screening for a Q&A, and trust us, you're going to have questions. We have more details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a film that premiered at the 2012 Sundance Film Festival. It's where we spoke with the filmmakers Rodney Asher and Tim Kirk about their bizarre and compelling documentary, Room 237. We're showing the film next Wednesday night as part of our Through the Lens series in partnership with the Utah Film Center. We've got more details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Rodney Asher, you've said the film in some ways is about what it means to be a fan. What do you mean?
Well, to be fair, that's the Sundance catalog.
Oh, it wasn't
description,
you. Okay.
Not mine.
Okay.
But it is about what it means to be really invested in a film and to accept that film as part of your identity, that you spend so much time in it. I mean, one thing that I love, it's a nice coincidence that this body of compelling analysis we found happens to be on this film and not Star Wars or something. Because there's a really interesting parallel between in The Shining, we have a story of a couple of people trapped in a grand hotel full of mysteries. And our film is about a couple of people trapped in a grand film full of mysteries.
Yeah.
And you know, our film is not Trekkies. It's not about – there are no shining weddings. You know, there's no one driving around in a yellow
really?
VW
there
bus.
Really? There isn't?
No.
Well, there may be.
That you've been able to find, right?
Well, we haven't found it.
But that would have been off topic, even if I would have loved – I would have found it incredibly fascinating.
Yes.
But it wouldn't have been part of this film.
It would not have been included, yeah.
I want to ask you about there is this idea of Kubrick's sort of the way he went into a film that was unlike any other a filmmaker in a lot of ways. And this is Bill Blakemore again talking about just how Kubrick was thinking of this something more than just a horror film and how he researched all of this. And he tells this really great story. I wanted to play an excerpt from the film. Where Blakemore, I think it's Bill anyway, goes to Estes Park.
Yeah, that's Bill.
Yeah, to the Stanley Hotel, and he talks to the manager. And he gets this insight about the way Kubrick is thinking about the film, because he gets a phone call from Stanley Kubrick. Here it is, another excerpt from the film Room 237.
This fellow told me that he got a phone call from Stanley Kubrick, who said, I think I want to make a movie about The Shining. And then he would keep this fellow on the phone for a long time. He said we had many long, long conversations in which he picked my brain about everything. And at that point, he said Kubrick was talking about maybe coming here to make the movie here. which I expect at that point that fellow liked the idea of, so it would make his hotel famous. And Kubrick said, I'd like to send out a research team. And so he then set out, the man said it was something like two or three people who came out here and stayed here for two or three months, taking photographs everywhere. And they spent a lot of time also down in Denver in the Colorado State Archives, finding out, as I would now expect, the full history of Colorado, which the flag of which plays a part. And the gold rush, the Colorado gold rush, was also a very big event. And there's still a lot of American Indian white people tension in Colorado with Navajos and Arapahos just to the south. This research team found out absolutely everything about Colorado, about Estes Park, about the Stanley Hotel, about its entire history, took photographs all over the place. 3 months was the impression I have of what he said about how this research team gathered absolutely everything.
That's so great. I mean, it gives you an insight. Is that, do we know, is that what Kubrick did with all of his films? Did he do that kind of?
He certainly did a ton of research. I mean, one thing we didn't want to do in our film was consult with people behind the scenes.
Yeah.
This movie is about...
Really? That's interesting.
Well, this movie is about the chain reactions that would happen in the minds of people watching the movie.
Yeah.
This wasn't an investigation into what went on in the making of the film, although, of course, Bill and Jeffrey and some of these people have done their own research.
Sure.
And it comes out in stories like this. But, you know, if you read about Eyes Wide Shut, or there's an amazing documentary, Kubrick's Boxes, where he talks about, like, some of the lengths that they went doing the research for that one.
Yeah.
He did do an imposing, formidable amount of research. I remember I read a story about the making of AI. You know, of course, Steven Spielberg wound up directing it. But at one point, he telephoned Macy's in New York, and he got transferred to the guy in the tie department. And he said, what can you see outside of your door? I know there's a glass wall on the northeast corner of Macy's in New York. And because he was plotting out what the city would look like underwater, you know, in 100 years, he needed to know that vantage point. And he would do that kind of research himself. In that, as well as, you know, his reputation as a genius, the incredible series of masterpieces leading up to The Shining, and the amount of time he spent making these movies. I mean, he had a great way of shooting where, unlike his peers who are working on similar budgets, a lot of major motion pictures are made on a very tight budget. Well, a big budget of money, but a really small budget of time.
Yeah.
And there would be things like, you've got 45 minutes to shoot this scene, and then we go to this scene and this scene, and they're really kind of married to the clock. But he would try to work with a much smaller crew and have maybe a simpler lighting setup so that he could shoot much longer, so he could spend much more time shooting. And all those kind of things lend people the pretty accurate idea that there are more things in this, that most details in this movie are intentional.
We liken it to like biblical inerrancy. You know, it's
right,
like
right.
It's like if it's there, if it's in the book, if it's in the film, it's there for a reason, and you can't discard it. You have to, you know, make it fit with the rest of the film.
Like a continuity error in Friday the 13th is most likely just a continuity error.
Yeah.
But he spent a lot more time and care making this film, so it is at least investigating if there's another explanation for some of the interesting details around the edges of the film.
Well, there's so many interesting details in the film. For example, there's a moment that freaked me out a little bit where there's this little cartoon Walt Disney dopey sticker on
right?
the door at one particular moment. Now, this is Danny's room,
yeah.
Right? It's on the room. Later in the film, you know, all the other characters that are on the door are still there. Dopey's gone.
Right. Jeffrey Cox believes, and this is we see in a tracking shot that Dopey is on the door before Danny has his vision, in which he sees blood and he sees the twins and he sees dead bodies. And then in the next scene, it's gone from the door.
Yeah.
And his feeling is that because the character is Dopey, that Danny has lost his innocence. He now has seen the horrors of the world. And he's no longer a dope.
Well, and that ties into the way Jeffrey sees a whole run of Kubrick films, I think starting from Lolita, as enlightenment of children in dangerous situations who have to confront a troubling world, you know, and come out the other side.
Yeah, that's very important in his research, is that that's a trope that runs through all of his films, all of Kubrick's films.
So I guess here's the question I think the film raises as well. Does it matter? Does it really matter? If a piece of art elicits a powerful reaction, and you see symbols and patterns and meaning, does it really matter if the artist intended that? What do you think?
I think that's an amazing question. I don't think we set out to answer it. Yeah. I think we set out to ask it.
Yeah, yeah.
There was a mantra that emerged in our conversations as we were making this film, where we would start to go down one of these rabbit holes and like, well, what do you think? What do you really think? And then one of the others would say to them, listen, remember, truth is not our concern.
Well, the truth of what went on behind the scenes.
Exactly.
But what is true is that this movie is powerful enough, complicated enough, and profound enough to stick with people and, you know, incite them to investigate this stuff.
Yeah. That's its own truth.
Let me play another moment. I'm not sure exactly who this is, to be honest. But they're getting at this idea of the author's intent.
It's Jeffrey Cox.
Jeffrey Cox. Here it is from the film, Room 237.
One can always argue that Kubrick had only some or even none of these in mind, but we all know from postmodern film criticism that author intent is only part of the story of any work of art, and those meanings are there regardless of whether the creator of the work was conscious of them.
Do we know, and that your film is not, as you said, is not about what Stanley Kubrick, how he made the film, but has he said anything about all of this? Do we know? Or do
well,
you,
he,
have you
he
even,
wouldn't.
Yeah.
Like
wouldn't
people,
know.
There's a story I read in one of his biographies about how people would talk to him and explain their ideas about what the end of 2001 really meant.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
that he loved to hear those stories and collect them, and he would never answer them definitively. And David Lynch is a similar guy who loves to create open-ended movies and provoke these interpretations. And he probably has a specific idea of what it means to him. And some people may tune in to exactly that meaning, but if other folks get something else, he loves that. He's happy that it's inspired, you know, those kinds of ideas.
Absolutely. And I think I mean, Julie Kearns, who is an author and has a webpage, is one of the people I interviewed, has done extensive work mapping the hotel.
Amazing.
Yeah. And this really works for me because what she's discovered is there's all these impossibilities, that there are windows that can't be exterior windows because there's two halls behind them, so the light could not be coming through them, all kinds of things. And I don't – it's hard for me to know if Stanley did that on purpose, but I can imagine he did because where it works for me is it really creates this sort of dreamlike quality to the film where there's some part of your brain that's going, something doesn't work.
Right.
This
yeah.
doesn't work. It wouldn't work.
And dream sequences are full of people walking between doors of rooms that couldn't possibly be connected. You awake from your bedroom and you open a door and you're at school.
Right.
And then you're an old man.
Yes, yeah. exactly. Yeah.
Well, there's this moment in the film which is terrific. And again, radio cannot do it credit, but it's the scene. There are three moments in the film where Danny's on his big wheel and he's going dashing around the hotel. And I think is it John?
That's John Fell Ryan.
John Fell Ryan sort of takes us through those three moments, which is terrific, I have to say. And you get a sense that first he's on the ground level, yet it's a tracking shot, and then it's wild.
He's all over the place. And yet John has found some meaning in that.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is really wonderful. One of which is that when he's in the second ride, when he's on the second floor, that he's exploring his parents' headspace, that they're in a mundane reality and he's up in a more fantastical one. And he has some pretty specific ideas about that, which really, really pretty awesome.
How do you think the question comes up in the film, how is the Shining meant to be seen? There's this great moment, John Fell Ryan, I think it is, who recommends to somebody who is screening the film that let's screen it backwards and forwards at the same time and superimpose it and see what we get from that. Say something about that in your sense of what's the sort of the best way to see The Shining, you think?
The best way to see The Shining. You know, in a dark room with the music on really loud.
Yeah.
Because one thing that always that strikes me about the movie is how present the soundtrack is, how dramatic the music is, and what he does with the voices – And I don't know, to watch it on a regular TV at a low volume, you don't get a sense of how enveloping the music is. And actually, I think Jeffrey Cox, not in our film, but further in his writing, he's got a book, The Wolf at the Door, and, mm-hmm. and another one that he edited, finds a lot of meaning about the music choices that he's picked and sort of the titles which have references to Bible stories or connections to World War II that are really kind of eerie when you think about them and you see where they relate in the movie. And for me, I always love Stanley Kubrick's use of music in all his films. I think he's a really pioneer in using amazing juxtapositions, even in like Dr. Strangelove, where we hear a love theme as the airplanes are refueling at the beginning of the movie. Right. And I teach editing in Los Angeles sometimes, and I talk about how what's amazing about that scene is he's using the music to give us the point of view of the airplanes. And when the point of view of the music is with a character who the audience doesn't relate to, you get a really fascinating, surprising contrast.
Yeah. Like, I guess the point is go see it.
Go see it.
Yeah.
Play it loud.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
you watch it, it watches you, and something happens.
And then see it again.
Right. Yeah. Let me ask you this. We've got less than a minute left. But you asked, there's this question where you ask, why would he make it so complicated? Do you feel like you got at that question?
I was amazed that he had an answer. I was kind of at a point where I was like, well, let me poke him a little bit.
Right.
And, I mean, he came right back with, well, what about Finnegan's Wake? And he did this in order to trap me and obsess me. And he built this maze for me to get lost in.
Yeah. But he says, but there are exit points. Danny gets out. Danny escapes.
Yeah.
So maybe there's hope for all of us.
Exactly. That's Tim Kirk. He and Rodney Asher produced and directed the documentary film Room 237. We spoke with them at the 2012 Sundance Film Festival, where their film premiered. We're screening Room 237 next Wednesday night at 7 at the Rose Wagner Performing Arts Center in partnership with the Utah Film Center. You can learn more about all of that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.